We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today, Mike Lechleitner. Mike is a Army veteran. He's a DOD employee currently, and he's got an interesting story to tell about a base over in Uzbekistan that you may or may not have heard of, often referred to as K2 because the name's almost impronounceable. But Mike, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Jim. Thank you very much.
Well, let's start with this. How did a nice guy, how did Mike Lechleitner, boy, I'm having trouble with that, find himself in the Army?
I graduated from high school with the lowest GPA of the class president and president of the vice president of the activities student council.
So this was clearly your path forward.
Yeah, absolutely, and it greatly helped me out later in life. And then after that, I came back to Ann Arbor and went to University of Michigan.
And you served from 1978 to 1981 and were a communications specialist. And tell us where you were stationed.
I was stationed in Augsburg, Germany at Field Station Augsburg, which was a NSA Army Signal or Army Security Agency site down by Munich. So it was a great, great, great time.
Well, and we won't even talk about how much German beer you consumed during that tour.
Oktoberfest was always a highlight.
Absolutely, yeah. I've been over there for that. I don't think anybody who's ever served in Germany has walked away from it without going, wow, that was a lot of fun, and the Autobahn is something to drive. So,
absolutely, yeah. Augsburg was a good location. We were 40 minutes from the slopes in the Alps, so that worked out great. 40 minutes by train.
Well, not every assignment's quite as enjoyable, but that one can be. So that's great. You came back, went on to college, got involved in similar intelligence sort of things, and as a DOD employee, it's about 2001, I think it is, you find yourself being sent off to Uzbekistan. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
I was serving as an executive officer in one of my organizations, and we were, of course, responding to the 9/11 attack and volunteered to go to the next place that came up and was told you're going, asked where, was told we can't tell you, and then did a couple of long plane rides and landed in the middle of the night in Karshi-Khanabad, Uzbekistan, which is one of the former Soviet republics and located where the base was located about 90 miles north of the northern border of Afghanistan.
Yeah, let's set this up for folks because most of us couldn't find Uzbekistan on a map. As you say, it's one of the former Russian stans. There's four or five of them. They are not far from Afghanistan. They kind of have China as a neighbor. Certainly Russia's a neighbor. I mean, it's kind of crowded right in there in the mid-Asia hotspots, I suppose.
Yeah. You're correct. It is one of the stans, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan. That's the one closer to China. Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan all border another stan, and that being Afghanistan. So it was the southern stans or southern states or provinces or whatever you want, republics actually, what the Soviets called them, in the former Soviet Union.
They're north of Afghanistan, as you mentioned, and they're kind of north of Iran.
Correct.
They're west of China and south of Russia, as we try to frame this for people. The Caspian Sea's kind of there on the west a little bit, and it's a country that has a population of about 34 million people. It's 90% Muslim. It has a long history, world history, you know, looking at Alexander the Great and the Mongols and Genghis Khan before the Russians kind of took it over during the 1900 to maybe 1990, the Soviet Union falls apart, Uzbekistan and the other stans all kind of become independent states at that point. So it's an interesting place. How is it that the United States ended up at this particular base awaiting whatever was going to happen down in Afghanistan some 20 years ago?
Sure. Important thing to remember is anytime you do a military operation is just like real estate, location, location, location. The Karshi-Khanabad, or K2, was actually one of the last, or was the last main Soviet base before going into Afghanistan when they had their long debacle there as well. So that base had already served as the jumping off point for units going into Afghanistan when the unit members were named Ivan and Boris. It was an obvious location for where the U.S. would want to go, and through an agreement with the Uzbekistan government, a quick survey was done immediately after 9/11, and special operators began arriving there with me within middle of October of 2001. And it served as the jump-off point for a lot of operations in northern Afghanistan that got the Taliban out of there in about 100 days and put bin Laden in a cave up in Tora Bora. And a lot's been written about it, not so much the base itself, but the operations that started from there. That's the movie that came out with the, what was it called, Horse Soldiers or something like that, with the guys on horseback, you know, fighting off the Taliban using forward air controllers.
Yep, yep.
Mike Spann was based there before he went downrange, one of our first casualties in the war there at Mozar Sharif. And so it was, again, location, location, location.
And just to frame this a little bit, K2, this former Soviet base, was used by the U.S. from about 2001 to 2005. And I think I saw somewhere something like 15,000 I assumed it's 15,000 U.S. troops passed through K2. That may or may not include civilians like yourself, but that's sort of the time frame and the group of folks who came through K2, as I understand it. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, the numbers are very iffy. Originally, the Department of Defense and the VA came out with only about 5,000 were there. My orders when I went to Southwest Central Asia, that's all my orders said. They were not specific, and that was true for many of the special forces operators. Our orders were very vague. So it was difficult many years later to backtrack and figure out exactly how many stayed there for any length of time. And then also complicating the fact is that as a logistics base and an air base, there were a lot of air crews that went in and out of there and stayed only a short time. So the number has gone up from originally an estimate of about 5,000 up to 15,000. But it's going to be dependent on the duration within that larger number of, was this just an air crew transiting, and how long were they exposed to stuff there?
Yeah, and let me set this up too, that because I'm my next comments, I don't want to get Mike in trouble here. Mike's here as a DOD employee who spent some time at K2 and has been involved in trying to get VA and Congress to recognize, the Department of Defense to recognize some of the challenges at K2 that I'm going to have him talk about here. But he's not here giving any endorsements and any political opinions on behalf of anybody but himself. He's not endorsing any of the veteran radio sponsors. He's not taking political positions between different administrations. This is a discussion about what he saw, what he knows, and kind of trying to inform our veteran radio listeners about a place that they've probably never heard of, K2 in Uzbekistan, so that you can be educated about the situation. And when you land at the base, Mike, nobody's thinking about toxic base problems. And unfortunately, the DOD has a long history of toxic base problems that raise their heads many years later. It's just not something you think about, or they think about, in the middle of the heat of the moment. And at some point after you leave K2, When do you become aware of or start thinking about, boy, there were some problems there, and maybe those problems actually showed themselves while you were there?
Sure. There were some problems. We'll start off with the problems that occurred there and then how I basically finally got back around to this almost 20 years later. We had a long C-17 flight from the U.S. To K-2. We were too heavy to take off, fully loaded, and not enough priority for an in-flight, so we hopped around the world, and about the 15 of us on the plane with all of our equipment picked up a few additional passengers. And the U.S. government never goes to war without a lawyer, and one of them was a JAG.
Well, that's we have a good union, that's why.
Yeah. So he was on a long flight that we circled the globe and made many stops on and got to know him, at least by name. And we started off doing our separate jobs, and I was in a different area, a little small area. First thing is, we didn't own the whole base. The Americans were confined to an area roughly only about 40 acres on the base. And when you think of an air base, that's huge. I mean, the area that we were in was small, but an air base is huge. So we were corralled into a very small area, the government, or us, decided for force protection measures that we needed a berm around our area. So one of the first jobs that the JAG had was to arrange for local contractors to bring in equipment. And in Uzbekistan, a lot of that equipment was some guy with a shovel. And start building a berm around the roughly 40 acres in which we were to live in. And the area we were to live in had no housing, was all dirt, was being improved by U.S. Military Corps of Engineer and CB-type folks daily, attempting to get a camp up on a little piece of this airbase. So back to the JAG, I just concluded some night operations and was coming back for some needed sleep when he stopped me walking across our little 40 acres and said, "Mike, I'd like your help. I know you can reach back to Washington. I've hired some contract workers to dig the berm around the place or build the berm around the place, and they're falling over getting sick." So I said, "Well, I can see what I can do." So then we met with, I had a series of areas where I would call back to Washington and try and get information on the base history and what was where and where in various locations around the base and what was there, its history, so to speak, and then relay that on to the JAG where he could make some determinations about what they should do about the work and the workers. That raised some attention, and almost within a week of me being there working with him, he introduced me to another guy, and this one was another military officer, and he was from the Center of Health and Preventive and Protective Medicine Europe out of UCOM, and he and a team were environmental specialists that were going to do a survey of the base. Now, this was our area at the base. Now, remember, this is after we've already been there and are growing every day. So the first survey was not done before we got there. It was done while we were getting there and building there. So I relayed the various information on the base's history to the CHIPM's officer on a daily basis while he and his team went out and surveyed. And I also recommended areas where they could do some soil samples and do some test digging to see what was in the dirt and what was making the workers sick. The area smelled, much like the Soviet Union would, but there's definitely a smell of petroleum in the air to begin with, but that would be expected to be at a jet base, but it was bad.
And that's right. I mean, you'd expect a certain amount of contamination or toxic exposure at any Air Force base, jet fuel and what have you. But it wasn't that. It was it turned out over time to determine that this had been a chemical weapons decontamination unit involved.
Correct. Yeah. We went through a series of things where I became Mr. Bad News. I was identifying these areas based on both the CHPM's team and the information we got back from Washington on the base's history. So, for example, when we started off about, well, it could be jet fuel that's making these guys sick, we dug a test hole, and after about 8 feet down, a gold-colored liquid started rising up to the surface that was smelled enough to be flammable. And that was because the Soviets had a jet fuel pipeline under the area we had been in that had been leaking for 30 years. So basically the soil was saturated with jet fuel. Then we dug another test hole behind one of their maintenance hangars, and that rose up with the infamous black goo, and that was because the Soviets had dumped all their petroleum distillates, their POL, their hydraulic fluid, anything from an aircraft directly behind the hangar, which was running through the water table that ran to our base, which was literally 25 feet away.
And that brings us back to where was your water for cooking, bathing, consumption?
Right. At the time, everything was coming in on the back of a C-17, including bottled water. Later, they built in a filtration plant, which I understand through follow-on sources within the Camp Stronghold Freedom Foundation.org, which is the group of the K-2 veterans that have banded together. There was some water quality problems with the filtration unit, obviously, that the Army brought in as well. But that was much later, after the base became a real base.
And it didn't stop there with those chemical exposures.
No, it did not. Yeah. So we had the hole with the golden oil coming up. We had the hole with the black goo. And then information came back from Washington that a Soviet decontamination unit had been active at the airfield back when the Soviets owned it. That's very rare. Nobody likes to spray chemicals on an airplane to decontaminate them. It tends to make the airplanes and the bombs not work very well. So a decontamination unit at an airbase was suspect. The decontamination unit is a mobile unit, so it was brought in or flown in from somewhere. It was not a local base asset. And the thing to remember was this happened during the Soviet incursion into Afghanistan, and there were press reports and later confirmed through a national intelligence estimate that the Soviets had used chemical weapons in Afghanistan. That national intelligence estimate has been declassified under Freedom of Information Act and is available, and states that the Soviets used some type of chemical weapons in their actions against the Afghanistan, Taliban, etc.
And all of that decontamination, again, paint the picture for our listeners here, Michael Lechner. You're just washing this stuff down. You're washing it off the plane, but it's not being captured and treated. It's just going into the ground, right?
Correct. And decontaminant, most chemical warfare officers have told me, the decontamination agents they use aren't the most friendliest things in the world either. So just because you use decontamination agent doesn't mean you clean it. It means you get the really bad stuff off and leave some not so bad stuff behind. So that was an operation. So I had to brief the folks at the base that POL, chemical, and then the CHPM's team, that Center for Health and Preventive Medicine team, actually met with and toured with the Uzbeki base officials. And they told the CHPM's team, the information that I had as well, that after the fall of the Soviet Union, of course, now the Uzbeki Air Force owns the base, and that a portion of our base that we were on, the 40 acres, a portion of that was actually a part of an air-to-surface missile depot, an ammunition depot. That depot blew up in 1994. And The explosion took out major buildings and storage areas all across the depot and blew up ordnance and pieces of ordnance all over the area in which we were living and in which the berm was being constructed with.
Well, this is why that 40 acres was available.
Yeah, at a discount. In addition, the Uzbeks told the Chippums officer that, and you got to remember, after the fall of the Soviet Union, everybody was grabbing what they could to sell, that the Uzbeks informed the Chippums team that the local Uzbek, you want to call it warlord or former Soviet boss, was storing yellowcake uranium at the depot. It was a secure place, and I don't know what the price was for yellowcake, but it's currently going about $30 a pound now. So, and anyways, it was valuable.
And let me frame this again, Mike, for folks. Yellowcake's refined uranium ore, and you might say, well, why is that there? Well, Uzbekistan is, or was, one of the most important sources of Russian uranium supplies up until its independence in 1991, and the country is still the seventh largest uranium supplier in the world. So it makes some sense that this was available in the region.
That's correct. And more alarming, but hopefully nothing ever happened, we were also 90 miles from Iran. So anyways, they were storing some valuable stuff in that depot. And through a series of sympathetic detonations, when the depot blew up, it destroyed the depot and spread out over the area in which we were setting up our little 40-acre camp. The Chippums team discovered yellowcake. It was handed to me in a marked baggie. Hey, do you know what this is? No, it's yellowcake. What the heck is it doing here? Got the explanation.
And why in the hell did you just hand it to me in a baggie?
Well, excuse me. It's not short term. You know, it's very low grade. It's the first step up from raw uranium, so to speak. So it is safe to handle, but you not necessarily want to be around it for a long time and particularly breathe dust of it. Which the whole base, if you think of the desert, that's kind of what it looked like anyways, was dusty. So the other thing the Uzbeks told them, or I'm sorry, that the Chippums team discovered, they discovered fragments of depleted uranium in around the depot and around our area. And this was, again, due to the explosion, because there had been depleted uranium munitions stored in the depot, and when they blew up, they fragmented and were spread out. Also, when the depot blew up, it was an air-to-surface missile depot. Much of the missile components, which makes sense when you're firing something with a fire at the end of it, contained asbestos and other types of materials. So all that was blew up and spread all over the area in which we were living in. And also, more importantly, it was a prime source for the soil that was being used to construct the berm that surrounded us on three sides.
Now, you get there in late 2001. How long are you there, Mike?
I got there the second week in October, and as much like we expected, we came to Afghanistan and kicked butt, and there wasn't much left for us to do, at least in this initial campaign of, you know, removing the Taliban government and hopefully getting bin Laden. That didn't quite work out right. But I was out of there by just after January 2002. So I was only there about 3 months. Now, the base continued.
That's my point.
Until 2005, and people stayed there longer because it became a logistical base for operations further south in Afghanistan, just like the Soviets did.
So in those first 2 or 3 months, all of this information is coming out about the history, the toxic base history of K2, and military strategic reasons, they continue to use it for the next roughly three or four years.
That's correct. Yeah, we actually were asked to leave Uzbekistan by the Uzbekistan government when we didn't agree with their human rights record. So we were forced to leave in 2005. There was the initial CHIPMS, the Center for Health and Preventive Medicine survey, that I contributed to or helped provide some information to in 2001. There was a follow-on visit and more comprehensive survey done, I remember my dates here correctly, 2002, 2003, toward right in the middle there, like the beginning of 2003, where they did some additional soil studies. And there were also then reports of nerve gas being detected by the chemical detection readers that were set up at the base as the base became more established. And the closure of one of the hardened aircraft bunkers where the detectors went off, and then a decontamination of that by U.S. forces, I think it was in 2004. So the base had gained somewhat of a reputation as not the cleanest place in the world, beginning in 2001, all through its eventual closure in 2005.
So this sets up the... what was happening at K2 in 2001 and why today it's a concern as a toxic base and a concern for those who got stationed there, maybe as 15,000 or so soldiers. We appreciate this information, Mike Leitner. And if you have time, I'd like to now talk about moving on to the efforts to recognize the impact of those toxic exposures to the military service members who passed through there.
Sure.
Now, we've gone a little longer, Mike, than we had anticipated, so I want to make sure you got another 20 minutes it's probably going to take.
Okay.
If that's okay with you.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay, I'll clip this piece out and put the pieces together. But so let me kind of come into segment two. We're talking to Mike Leitner, who is a Army veteran, who's now a DOD employee, and back in 2001 was one of the early folks to end up at a base in Uzbekistan, commonly known as K2. He's told us about the toxic concerns that were raised in those early months of use of this base, which was a former Soviet air base. And we've talked about golden oil coming out of the ground and black goo and decontamination, chemical decontamination units, and the ordnance depot explosion and identifying of yellow cake and depleted uranium. Really a toxic brew, as many people would call it. And over time, there was a recognition that there were potentially health effects from those who were stationed there and exposed there between this period of 2001 to 2005. And this has picked up a national interest in Congress. And I think there's kind of a recognition that the VA, and I'll quote Senator Baldwin here, who said the VA should avoid repeating past mistakes like it did with Vietnam veterans and quickly move forward with recognition and coverage for any diseases associated with exposure to toxic substances such as depleted uranium. But it hasn't been easy to get the information out or any recognition by DOD, VA, or Congress. Mike, you've been pulled into this effort. Can you talk to us about sort of what's gone on to try to get some recognition here?
Sure. Probably the best way would be the way I found out about it. You know, I moved on in life after that. An important thing to remember that many of the illnesses that seem to be occurring are those of that take a while to develop. These are cancers and some issues with the females that were assigned there, reproductive issues. It just takes a while for the effects to give a notice. And I went on with my life and was pretty much knew the base was closed and thought, well, that's great. Nobody's got to be there in that crap hole anymore. and never really thought about the health effects. And then COVID hit, and the director of my agency, as part of our COVID thing, said, let's do buddy checks. Let's talk to people who, you know, were an impact on our lives, and we want to make sure they're okay. And so last Memorial Day weekend, I got to thinking about it, and I went out online and found the Camp Stronghold Freedom Foundation organization.org, and their associated website on Facebook on Karshi, and found that a lot of folks were getting sick, had been or had already died due to rare cancers, and got in contact with the group to ask to join, and they said, we need to talk to you after the you answer some of the questions as to why you want to join the group. I did so, and then began this effort. So literally almost we're not even up to a year of my involvement with it. What I found is a VA that has decided that Karshi Khanabad did not support the efforts against the Taliban in 2001 in terms of VA benefits because it was in Uzbekistan. It was 90 miles away from Afghanistan. But that magic border has caused many of the veterans to pay out of their own pocket for treatment or discovery and diagnosis of illnesses that have happened because they were exposed there. And several medical doctors have verified that based on the patients they've seen, and was the subject of a CBS News story that I contributed to with Catherine Herridge, and that showcased one of the veterans in a wheelchair in Florida, and all the diagnoses and everything came out of his own pocket, VA not paying for it, because we are 90 miles off the border at one of the most contaminated Soviet bases there was. And the Soviets are well known for contaminating. So we've moved through the process now for this last year with several appearances on the Capitol Hill. Jon Stewart, the comedian, has joined in our efforts as well as part of a larger effort on burn pits. We had one too, by the way, at K2. Everybody's got a burn pit. So we've been trying to move this through the VA to get them to recognize it. And they've come back with just consistently, well, we need more study. Which goes against right with you have with your senator's comment about if you wait long enough and do a study, you won't need to do a study anymore because they'll be dead.
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly what the Vietnam veterans feel on Agent Orange, is they have had to fight tooth and nail to move Agent Orange from on the boots on the ground in Vietnam to the rivers, the brown water navy, to the blue water navy just recently by legislation. But Agent Orange was all over the place. It was in Korea, it was in Thailand, it was in Guam. Not all those folks, and it was in the United States, not all those bases have been recognized as connecting to Agent Orange exposure. So it's a legitimate concern to say, geez, we'll just ignore the exposures at K2, and if we ignore them long enough, the pool of potential applicants gets, and those exposed gets smaller and smaller. So I think the efforts of those who've passed through there can look back at that history and say, we have a legitimate concern for why we're pushing so hard.
Correct. Yeah, and it's not been answered either through the VA or the DOD. Their last congressional testimony appearance was a joke. It is clear that they, based on their testimony, that they did not talk to each other. The DOD providing the base history to the VA and the VA saying we need more study. And then actually in one particularly, I want to say sadly, hilarious instance, the VA doctor saying, well, yeah, we can't find the yellow cake that the Chippen's team found. And oh, by the way, we're not really concerned about the depleted uranium, because when the depot exploded, the berm would have absorbed it, meaning the DU fragments. That's pretty hilarious in the fact that that berm was not built until we built it. So it must have been a magic berm to contain the depleted uranium that was spread all over the base, and then we all managed to be working around for the next 5-6 years when we were there.
And again, let me set this up that, Mike Leitner's here in his individual capacity, having experienced this. He's currently a DOD employee, but he's not here endorsing any political opinions or any sponsors of Veterans Radio. He's just trying to get the facts out as he knows them. And Mike, one of the concerns we've often seen is, and it's true today with PFAS contamination at Air Force bases, that VA won't act on this stuff because they need more studies, or they've got to have a medical nexus for which there isn't enough research going on to be able to provide it, and an average doctor can't. So you almost have to get Congress involved to move these issues along so that Congress tells VA to act. And that's a little bit of what's going on here with K2. Tell us how that action is proceeding.
Sure. Well, we were unsuccessful in the 116th Congress to get a bill actually through. However, it was a bipartisan proposal/bill that just didn't make it to a vote in the last Congress. And this Congress, again, Congressman Mark Green of Tennessee and Lynch of Massachusetts, bipartisan, have instituted legislation that all your listeners, after you research the issue and want to support, and could call your congressman and their aides and tell them, please support H.R. 1355, which grants presumptive status to folks that were deployed to K2 for a set list of illnesses which are all related to toxic exposure. Over in the Senate, I'm sorry, the senator's name escapes me, but it's also bipartisan. There's a bill, Senate Bill 454, which does the same thing.
And let me point out, these bills would not impact you at all because you were there as a civilian, not as a military service member.
Absolutely correct, and I'm just fortunate that thank God my health is okay so far. But even if passed, I have no dog in this fight personally.
So
in terms of any benefits received by me.
So let me summarize this again. If you're interested,
we're only talking about 15,000 people at the best estimate, large estimate by the VA. And so we'll go forward from there. And I'll highlight, give you a little background on some of the problems that vets are currently having. Because K2 wasn't recognized as being in the theater of operations, they weren't in any database where they could register their illnesses because their site didn't show up. So it wasn't geolocated to where illnesses could be tagged to. After it started to get a little more attention and a almost obsessive interest in the VA on depleted uranium, ignoring the yellow cake and the possibility of a yellow cake inhalation, they then reluctantly agreed that, well, one of those things we could do is offer any vet that says they were at K2 a depleted uranium urine test. If individual VA offices knew even to offer it, which they didn't because they didn't put out a communique about it. Next, if you managed to know about it and requested a test, you would send your urine in a gallon milk jug to a facility in Baltimore, in Maryland, the only one in the U.S. that the VA had to do the studies, and that was closed due to COVID.
This sounds like it's
so
getting...
their ability to get data to do a study, or their ability to get data, at least on the DU, on its effects, was non-existent because they couldn't do any tests.
But Mike, let me also bring up that there was some positive movement in 2020 on this issue, in that President Trump signed an executive order that recognizes veterans who served at this toxic base and kind of mandates a comprehensive study of health consequences, which is everybody's always their first step. Let's do a study. But tell us, did that executive order get repealed? What else has come up in the last 6 months that kind of has moved this forward some?
For the last 6 months, there was also the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the Department of Defense funding bill. And in that, Congress inserted that a study must be done and completed in 6 months. Even though its speed was good, its study parameters was a little vague, and prior to President Trump leaving office, he signed an executive order that stated a study must be done and completed in 12 months that was more complete in terms of toxic effect and history. And to my knowledge, and I'm not involved in the process, but I have not been contacted since I'm an eyewitness, so to speak. I do not know the status of the government's response to both the NDAA and the executive order. But the executive order has not been rescinded, and it appears the Biden administration is very supportive. And as you recall, the president's son, Bo Biden, died of brain cancer, which the president Biden has stated that he believes was could have been caused by Bo's exposure to burn pits in Iraq. So he's aware of the toxic ramifications.
So there's this two studies that are supposed to occur, sort of a little bit different in each, timing and parameter-wise. We don't know if they're started. There are a couple of bills in the current Senate, H.R. 1355 and Senate Bill, or S.B. 454. As you say, people can write their senators or their congressmen or women and tell them to support these two things to try to move that along, because what that'll do, if I understand this right, correct me if I'm wrong, if Congress says these are presumptive diseases, then we skip by all the importance of the studies and trying to having an expert on both sides. One says yes, one says no. These bills will move this right to, hey, these diseases that veterans are experiencing are to be presumptive. Is that what the bills talk about?
You're absolutely correct, Jim. The legislation that would be the holy grail in terms of it would be granted as presumptive status, meaning it that if you came down with one of the diseases or cancers on the list that is known to be associated with toxic exposure, you do not have to prove that that's where you got it from. It basically says it accepts that you as a service member was assigned to an area that was so toxic and you ended up getting this. We don't necessarily need you to prove, which was always the onus on the vets, which made it difficult, that that's where you got it from. So presumptive status allows the vet to say, I got cancer. It's this type of cancer. It was at, and I was deployed to this base. Help me out.
Well, this, as you say, is the holy grail. It cuts out years and years of studies and gnashing of teeth and medical experts. So I want to encourage our veteran radio listeners to write their congressmen and women, write their senators, talk about this issue. And that's why we're doing this show, is to kind of bring this to public attention. It had an impact before. It got at least the then president to execute an executive order. It's gotten it into the Defense Act last year for the study, and it's gotten new bills up, potential bills up in the current Congress. But that's what public exposure and pressure really does in a political process. Those are my words, not Mike. I'm not trying to get him in trouble. But that's what we're, you know, that's a call to action. Mike, if there are people out there who are interested in this issue for any number of reasons, maybe they have their own toxic-based problem that this ties back into, how do they track this issue? You've mentioned a website.
Oh, yeah. The Camp Stronghold Freedom Foundation.org, and the Stronghold Freedom Foundation is all one word, .org. Is the organization, it's a 501, so a charitable, of K2 veterans that supports not just this issue, but some tangential, that being like family members of deceased K2 veterans or those needing attention brought on them by the strength of the organization to the VA in individual cases. And then, of course, their big item of getting this K2 legislation passed. The site also has the listings of the documents. It also has the interviews. It has the testimony links to C-SPAN where you can see what the DOD or the VA is saying about it in testimony to Congress. And so that's a great first place to take a look. And then from there, they have other websites listed where you can get assistance for all kinds of traditional veterans issues as well.
Well, and again, this is a, you know, you mentioned, hey, K2 had its own burn pit problems, but there are a lot of bases that have some, maybe not all of these exposures, and K2 was a small base used for a definitive period of time. A smaller number of troops went through it. So if you can get some of these presumptions and recognitions for K2 where the math doesn't get too scary for the VA's budget, I think that helps all the other bases say, hey, I had this burn pit problem, which is big in Afghanistan, but unfortunately huge in numbers and is harder to move along. So it seems to me, at least, that you could move this one along because it's so definable. But that may help others, and that's why I recommend to veteran radio listeners, if these are issues of interest to you and your family members, visit CampStrongholdFreedomFoundation.org, and it may help you on your particular exposure or base issue as well. And again, that's my commentary, not Mike's. We're not trying to get him into trouble. But I think you described yourself as sort of a K2 witness. You know, you were there from day one, essentially, and it puts you in a unique role, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was. It's been an experience, like this. Kept running through the Forrest Gump movie through my head here. Just, you know, right place at the right time. And then many years later, sadly, becoming aware of the issue and then coming back to see what I can do about helping. But just happened to be there and was able to give information to both the CHPM's team and the JAG. And some of that lost in the bureaucracy many years later, and some of it maybe not want to be shown by the bureaucracy many years later. So I'm glad to be able to help out those who served. And when we went through with John Stewart, his first responder act for the 9/11 group that responded to the World Trade Center, I was talking to him, and he's now kind of using this as a line as well. I'm especially proud of the K2 group. We were America's first responders in terms of boots on the ground there. Lots have been written about the folks that went further downrange into northern Afghanistan at the beginning of the war. Much of it true, some of it Hollywood, but a very special group of special operators and special warriors that got the Taliban out of that country in 100 days and bin Laden in a cave.
Mike, we appreciate the extra time that you've given to Veterans Radio today. We appreciate your service to the country, your continuing work with DOD, and all the things that you're doing. And again, thank you for spending some extra time with Veterans Radio today.
I appreciate it, Jim. Thank you.